Well, turn with me again, please, if you have a Bible, to Mark's Gospel and chapter 3. And we shall be looking then at these verses 7 to 19, which I read earlier on in the service. And the two paragraphs then, which make up our passage this morning, present us with two very different scenes. The first has a frantic feel to it. These crowds desperately wanting a piece of Jesus. He's being besieged, basically, to such an extent indeed that in verse 9, precautionary measures have to be taken. An escape route has to be made available just in case things get really out of hand. In the second scene, however, there's a much calmer atmosphere. Jesus is on the front foot now. He's taking the initiative. He's dictating things with great authority and poise. He's engaging in important business. And thus, our two headings this morning are as follows. First of all, Jesus pursued at the lakeside. And then secondly, Jesus proactive on the mountainside. First of all, then this morning, Jesus pursued at the lakeside. And this is verses 7 to 12. And so in verse 7 then, we are told that Jesus withdrew. Presumably he's aware that people, his opponents, are plotting to kill him, verse 6. And this withdrawal is his response to that development. And it testifies, does it not, to Jesus' wisdom. We saw last week Jesus in the synagogue being confrontational. We said that love was his motivation. It was because he loved the stubborn-hearted people in that building that he exposed their stubborn hearts. But nonetheless, you can't get away from it. In verses 3 to 5, Jesus is confrontational. He's fiercely confrontational. He's uncompromisingly confrontational. But he isn't recklessly confrontational. He doesn't get carried away. He doesn't have to be physically and forcibly restrained by his companions as the synagogue service closes. He doesn't follow these people to their homes to continue the argument there, because he knows that that's a sure way to getting himself lynched. And he knows that he has a mission to complete, which doesn't include being lynched in some quiet Capernaum backstreet. He knows, in other words, when to stop. He knows when to retreat. He knows when to withdraw. And that's instructive, I think. Because for us too, there's a time to confront. And there's a time too when it's perhaps strategic to withdraw. I think of Christians I know who within their unbelieving families have bravely raise their heads above the parapet and address issues, the sexually promiscuous lifestyle a sibling is engaging in, the benefit fraud a parent is blithely undertaking, the obscene language a spouse persists in using, whatever it might be. But some of those Christians I'm thinking of have perhaps gone too far, and they've become too insistent and too relentless. They haven't been unwilling to let it drop. They haven't known when to withdraw. And they've permanently damaged relationships and forfeited future opportunities for gospel witness. How we all need God's help in this area, don't we? To be wise, like Jesus here is being wise, knowing when to confront, knowing when to withdraw. How we all need God's wisdom in these complex areas in which we so often find ourselves. But you'll notice then that while Jesus' withdrawal fulfills its main purpose, it puts clear daylight between him and the plotters of verse 6, it doesn't secure the kind of quiet seclusion for which he may well have been hoping. Rather, he's pursued to his lakeside haven by this large crowd. So these aren't the Pharisees and Herodians that have been mentioned in verse 6. These are people who are much more favourably disposed toward Jesus. They are enthusiasts. And it raises the question then, what should we make of this? How should we assess this development, this crowd now pursuing Jesus out to the lakeside? Well, on the one hand, there's a thrilling aspect to it. Look at the makeup of this crowd. Geographically, all points of the compass are represented here. Galilee to the west, Judea, Jerusalem, and Idumea to the south, the regions across the Jordan to the east, Tyre and Sidon to the north. And ethnically, we proceed from the pure Jewishness of Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem to the somewhat mixed situation of Idumea and the regions across the Jordan to the unambiguously Gentile status of Tyre and Sidon. In other words, this is a remarkably diverse bunch of people we're talking about here. And surely it's a little reminder that this son of David, this Galilean, this Nazarene, this Bethlehem-born Jew has come to be an international saviour. The importance of Jesus Christ transcends all geographical and ethnic considerations. He's a saviour for anyone who has inherited from Adam a guilty record and a corrupt heart. And that's all Judeans and all Idumeans and all Sidonians and all English and all Scots and all Welsh and all Irish and all South Africans and all Americans. It includes you this morning. Jesus Christ is relevant to you. He's the one saviour of mankind, as we sang just now, to whom you need to go, regardless of who you are and where you're from and what blood flows through your veins. It's a thrilling little reminder of the international flavour of Jesus' saving significance. But while on the one hand there's a thrilling aspect to it, there's also, I think, a depressing aspect to this crowd scene. We saw last week those people in the synagogue in the first part of this chapter, and the way in which, you remember, they fully recognized Jesus' supernatural abilities. They believed he could heal. They accepted as genuine his unique miracle-working genius. And yet, rather than bowing to his majesty, they were looking for a reason to accuse him. And you know, these people here at this lakeside, in this next section of the chapter, their attitude is only slightly better than that. They too fully recognize Jesus' supernatural abilities. They too believe he can heal. They too accept as genuine his unique miracle-working genius. And yet, rather than bowing to his majesty, they are trying to take advantage of his powers in the most undignified and mercenary fashion. I mean, these people that we're presented with here, they're like sales shoppers on Boxing Day morning. You ladies know what I'm talking about. The doors open at 6 o'clock in the morning and people just pile in, and it's mayhem, it's a melee, it's survival of the fittest. Everyone just trying to grab any item of clothing off the shelves that they possibly can, and there's no time for browsing, and no time for deliberation, and no time for decency and good manners. The aim of the game is to get out of that shop with at least some treasures, some bargains in your shopping bag. And that's the kind of atmosphere we have here on this Galilean lakeside. The aim of the game is to battle your way to the front of the crowd and make some physical contact with Jesus and so derive some therapeutic benefit from his supernatural powers. And there's no decorum about it. There's no dignity about it. It's a melee. It's a scramble. It's a stampede. It's law of the jungle kind of stuff. Hence the need for the boat to be on emergency standby. Hence the disconcerting language Mark uses in verse 9 to keep the people literally from crushing him is the word that he uses. There's no reverence in these people. There's no awe in these people. There are no goosebumps on the flesh of these people. There's no holy restraint in the presence of Jesus Christ. Indeed, Mark brings this out. He establishes a very striking contrast. In verse 9, he tells us about these people in the crowd who are falling upon Jesus. That's the literal Greek term he uses. They are falling upon Jesus. In other words, they're all over him. He's trying to get a piece of him. And then in verse 10, in verse 11, he tells us about these evil spirits who are falling before Jesus, is the Greek term he uses there. And I think he's saying that at least the evil spirits are showing some awe. At least they're demonstrating some reverence. At least they've got goosebumps. Whereas the crowd simply regard Jesus as a source of personal gain. They at least are hit between the eyes by the sheer loftiness of Jesus' identity as the Son of God. And perhaps you're here in this church this morning and you're here because you're seeking some kind of personal gain from Jesus Christ. Perhaps for some time your life has been on a downward spiral. You've got problems coming out of your ears. You're in a mess. You've tried other solutions. And you're thinking, well, I may as well look into this guy Jesus and see what he might have to offer me. Well, if that's the case, I'm very glad you're here, but I have to tell you that more than anything, Jesus is the awesome, majestic, reigning Son of God. And more than anything, he's calling you this morning to worship him, to acknowledge him for who he is, to relinquish everything else in your life that you've ever lived for instead of him, and to enthrone him in your heart and in your life as Lord and as King. That's what these people here aren't doing. Will you do that? Will you enthrone him? Will you bow before him? Will you show him the reverence that is his right? Jesus pursued at the lakeside. Secondly, this morning, Jesus proactive on the mountainside. Jesus proactive on the mountainside. And this then is verses 13 to 19. In the hours following the installation of a new prime minister, there's usually great interest, isn't there, in what his cabinet appointments are going to be. People are wondering what sort of team he's going to assemble around himself. How many new faces? How many of the old guard? How many of his cronies? In David Cameron's case just over a year ago, how many Lib Dems? And so on. And here in this passage, we have Jesus then, a little bit like a newly installed prime minister, assembling his team. Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12. And I just want us to notice then two things. First of all, the role of these men, and secondly, the identity of these men. First of all, then, the role of these men. Well, we're told, aren't we, in verses 14 and 15, that they were commissioned by Jesus to preach and to drive out demons. And of course, as we read those two verses, our eyes immediately go to the second of those two things, the driving out of demons, the exorcism mandate which these 12 are given. And it perhaps causes us to ask a few questions and perhaps causes us a few concerns. And I just want to make three quick comments here. First of all, these men were unique. These men were unique. Now you'll notice from your NIV footnote that that phrase in verse 14, he appointed 12, designating them apostles, is of questionable authenticity. But doesn't really matter, because later on in the Gospel, in chapter 6 and verse 30, Mark quite definitely and non-controversially does refer to these 12 men as apostles. In other words, they possessed a special office, an office which no longer exists in the Christian church. Hence, the number 12, which of course is a significant number. It's a significant number in the Bible, suggestive of being foundational, the 12 sons of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel, which their descendants became. And hence the fact that as you come to the end of the New Testament and the apostles are dying off, in fact most of them have already died, you don't find a new generation of apostles being appointed. And hence the language that Paul uses in Ephesians 2:20, for instance, about the apostles being the foundation. That's the language he uses, the foundation upon which the church it would subsequently be built. And so there's something unique, there's something foundational about these 12 men. So that when we read verse 15, we can't just kind of directly apply that verse to us. Isn't that Jesus is sending us as Christians out to drive out demons? Jesus is talking here to these 12 men who are in this unique position, holding this unique office, which was for a temporary period in the history of the church. He's giving them the authority to drive out demons. And so we can't just kind of lift that verse out and say, oh, this is something that is applicable to all Christians. That's the first comment that needs to be made. Second comment, this doesn't detract from the glory of Jesus. This doesn't detract from the glory of Jesus. Some of you who have watched Toy Story 1 will remember that moment in the film when Buzz Lightyear discovers that he's only a toy. He's not a space ranger after all. He's just one of millions of other Buzz Lightyears going to any toy shop and they're lining the shelves. And that, of course, is a very significant moment for him. And on the face of things, it might seem like a bit of a Buzz Lightyear moment here. We've been reading Mark's Gospel and we've been seeing Jesus going around performing all these miracles and particularly driving out demons, and it's been so impressive. And we've been forced to conclude he must be the Messiah. And yet now we come to chapter 3, verse 15, and there are 12 other guys going out, also driving out demons. Perhaps Jesus isn't so special after all. Perhaps we should rethink our former conclusions about him. But we don't need to do that, because it comes back to a point that I've made several times, which is this. What was the purpose? What was the function of the miracles? The function particularly of the exorcisms? Well, the function, you remember, was to attest, to confirm, to prove, to demonstrate that the king had come, the promised king of the Old Testament, particularly the promised king of Genesis 3:15, who would crush the evil one, crush the serpent, crush Satan. The miracles were to attest and confirm that he had now arrived, the conqueror was present. But the miracles, the exorcisms, weren't the conquering work itself. The conquering work itself was going to be very different. It was going to be a death. Crucifixion. It was on the cross Jesus was actually going to crush the head of the serpent, defeat Satan himself. So that here you see there's no problem really with Jesus commissioning these men to go out and drive out demons. It's just a further attestation that the king is here. The king has arrived on planet Earth. But Jesus isn't commissioning these 12 apostles to go and die on a cross, because that's his work. It's there that his uniqueness lies. It's there that his uniqueness resides. He's going to be the one who solely will go to the cross and win the victory. And then the third comment here. That even though, as I've just said, these 12 men were unique, As they go around Palestine now, driving out demons, there is perhaps a line, a thread, which connects what they are doing there to our Christian lives here this morning. And that thread, that connection is this: that Jesus' conquest, Jesus' victory over the kingdom of darkness, is a victory which is shared by his people. That principle, I think, can be detected in these verses. Jesus' victory over the kingdom of darkness is a victory which is shared by his people. You see, you think of Peter, for instance, going round Palestine and going up to demon-possessed people and making those demons cower as he majestically commands them to leave. And it's remarkable, that, isn't it? I mean, we know a bit about Peter. We know what a frail man Peter was. We know Peter's foibles. We know Peter's weaknesses. It's a remarkable thing, that, isn't it, to think of Peter. Weak old Peter. Fallible old Peter, being able to go and drive out demons and cause the very powers of hell to flee before him. But you know, the New Testament actually presents us with something even more remarkable than that. There's a verse in the book of James, which I think is quite mind-blowing. It's James chapter 4 and verse 7, where in the second half of that verse, James writes this: resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, James here isn't talking about demons, about unclean spirits. James here is talking about the devil himself, the boss, the prince of darkness himself. And James isn't talking about apostles. He's talking about ordinary, beleaguered Christians dispersed from Jerusalem that he's writing to. He's talking about people like you and me, strugglers, hobblers in the Christian life like us. And he's saying that the devil will flee before you. He's saying that because of your connection to Jesus Christ, because of your union with the conqueror, you are now in a position to resist Satan's temptations, his suggestions. Go and do this. Go and think that thought. Go and say that word. This week that we're starting now, you can resist Satan's strategies. It's not easy. It won't happen effortlessly, but you can do it. You're joined to the conquering Jesus. And in that moment that you resist his temptations, in open-mouthed amazement, he will flee from you because he will see in you something of the image of your master as you resist his temptations. I'm saying then is that let's not kind of wish that we were apostles, wish that we were back there and part of those 12, because it's been so amazing to go around driving out demons. The New Testament describes an even more amazing phenomenon to us, that the devil himself will flee from us when we resist his temptations through the power of our conquering Jesus. So that's the role of these men commissioned to preach and to exorcise. But secondly, the identity of these men, because you'll notice then that in verses 16 to 19, we're given a very careful, a very meticulous list of these 12 men. And the word which springs out for me as I read this list of names is the word surprising. I think it's a surprising list. Let me give one or two reasons for saying that. First of all, there's a surprising obscurity here. A surprising obscurity. Okay, Peter, James and John, we know quite a bit about them. But you move on then to some of the later names. Andrew, don't know a great deal about him, do we? Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, we're not even certain whether that is Levi or whether it's a different person. Thomas, we know one incident very well, but not much else. James, son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot. Judas Iscariot, we certainly know a bit about him. But most of these guys, I mean, could you speak for a minute without repetition or hesitation or deviation about these people? Do you know much biographical detail? And it raises the question, why then do Mark and Luke and Matthew all give us this meticulous list? These people mostly don't figure again in the story. So why do we need to know their names if they're not going to be central characters? Perhaps not even appearing characters at all, then why do we need this list? Well, there may be various ways of answering that question, but perhaps the most important answer is this: that people in the first century world weren't, as we might often and easily caricature them, primitive and uneducated and unsophisticated and unintellectual people. They weren't people who would just uncritically and gullibly swallow anything you told them. And history then was in the first century world a proper academic discipline, just as it is now. And if people were going to take seriously an historical account, a piece of reportage, then they wanted to make sure it met certain criteria, and most importantly, that there were specific, identifiable eyewitness sources. That was a very important thing to people in the first century world. That if they were reading an account of something that happened, they wanted to know it had really happened. They wanted specific, identifiable eyewitness sources. And when, therefore, the gospel writers, early on in their gospels, give us these lists of names, these lists of 12 men who we're told in verse 14 were going to be with Jesus, they were going to be present for Jesus' teaching and Jesus' miracles and so on, it's these writers saying to their readers, look, I'm not here giving you just a load of traditions, a load of kind of half-truths, myths, legends, mixed in with a few facts that have kind of been circulating for ages and now I've picked up on them and I'm putting them down in writing. No, I'm here engaging in a rigorous, proper historical method. I have eyewitness sources and I'm going to name them, just as all proper historians do, just as Josephus would, just as any other historian would. I'm going to name my sources. In fact, in Mark's case, there was probably an additional element. Mark's writing so early, just a couple of decades after the events have happened, you can even go and ask these people if you want, and you can verify what I'm saying. Mark here is engaging in proper historical conduct. And it's reminding us then that these Gospels have to be taken seriously. You can't just dismiss them as being silly religious documents that just unintelligently mix fact and myth and all the rest of it. These claim to be proper historical documents, no less than Josephus' writing or Tacitus' writing. They have eyewitness names appended to them. Please don't dismiss the Gospels on those kinds of grounds. So there's a surprising obscurity. But then secondly, there's a surprising unsuitability. A surprising unsuitability. We've already had a bit of a flavour, haven't we, in this gospel of Jesus' ministry. And one of the scenes that we've encountered and explored was that one in chapter 2, verses 15 to 17, where you remember Jesus was in the house of Levi, and he was there at a meal with all these tax collectors and sinners. And of course we know from the Gospels, from our knowledge of the Gospels, that that wasn't a remarkable occasion, that that wasn't a unique occasion, that that was fairly typical. Jesus, throughout his ministry, was going to mix with those kinds of people, with people on the fringes of society, with people who, for whatever reasons, were considered disreputable and beyond the pale. And of course, mixing with those kinds of people was going to require a lot of patience, both on Jesus' part and on the part of his companions, the apostles who were going to be accompanying him. And that being the case, patience being an important requirement of being an apostle of Jesus, you can't help thinking these aren't the most suitable bunch of men. I mean, look at James and John and the nickname that they're given, Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. And we don't know for absolutely sure, but it seems pretty certain that they were given that nickname because they were fiery characters. And we have examples of them in the Gospels, don't we? Becoming fiery and wanting judgment to be poured down on Samaritan villages, for instance. Fire to come down from heaven. Now, if they're the kinds of people who are constantly wanting fire to come down from heaven on sinful people, then they're not going to fare very well in the houses of tax collectors and sinners. Or Simon the Zealot. Now, it used to often be said that he was the member of a political party, because we know of a political party that was known as the Zealots, and they then were very anti-Roman Jews who really, really hated the Roman occupation. But in actual fact, that political party didn't come into existence, or we don't know anything of it, until around the time of the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And this, of course, is before then. And probably then the term zealot is less technical, less official than in that other use of the word. And it simply means that he was someone who was very pernickety about the law, very fussy about the application of the law, and particularly that he would disapprove of those who were living a non-Torah kind of lifestyle. People like tax collectors and sinners. People who weren't going to the synagogue. People who weren't going through the cleansing rites and all the rest of it. He would have had a real thing about those kinds of people. And so he's not the best person you'd have thought to take along with you into the homes of these men. Why is this? Why didn't Jesus choose a more sorted bunch of people? Well, surely it's a little reminder, a little encouragement to every member of the church that will be built on the foundation of these apostles. That it's part of the definition, it's part of the essence of Christian experience that we are work in progress. J.I. Packer, in his book Keeping in Step with the Spirit, talks about how Christians of a former generation, I don't mean a long time ago, but perhaps at some point in the 20th century, presumably used to go around with letters on their, also with badges, I think, bearing the letters PBPGIFWMY, which stood for Please Be Patient, God Isn't Finished With Me Yet. And that's a good principle, isn't it? Please be patient, God isn't finished with me yet. Because never in this life is God finished with us. There were many rough edges on James and John and on Simon, which would be exposed in many of the situations Jesus took them into, and which would need to be smoothed gradually. And you can't help noticing that by the time John comes to write his epistles, many decades later, many of those rough edges have been smoothed. And you and I have many rough edges too. It's with those rough edges that we are called into Christian discipleship. And the smoothing of them will be a long and slow and tortuous business. And it's always useful to be reminded then, not least from the apostles themselves, that we do need to be patient with ourselves and with one another, because God isn't finished with us yet. A surprising obscurity, a surprising unsuitability, but then thirdly, a surprising notoriety. I'm referring to the last name on the list, Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Why was he chosen to be one of the 12 apostles? I don't think I can really answer that question. It's a mystery. It's part of God's sovereign providence. And of course, it was integral to the very crucifixion itself, and the accomplishment, therefore, of your redemption and mine. But whatever the precise reason, does it not, again, remind us of something? Does it not remind us that all of us, regardless of our privileges, need to be guarding our hearts? You could be an apostle of Jesus Christ. You could be in the 12. You could be one of those chosen to be with him day in, day out, listening to all his teaching, seeing all his miracles, benefiting from all the graces of his character in that daily first-hand exposure. And yet still, you could go and betray the Son of God for 30 pieces of silver. It's a theme that kind of continues throughout the rest of the chapter, and the way in which in the next section we encounter Jesus' family, his earthly biological family, his brothers on his mother's side, of course. And they too are privileged. They've been brought up in the same house as the Son of God. Again, so much exposure to him, and yet at this point, they reject him as Messiah and a Son of God. You can be brought up in a Christian home. You can be the member of a church. You can be part of an eldership. You can have privileges coming out of your ears. But you must never be complacent. You must never stop watching yourself. You must never stop guarding against the evil one. Right up until our dying days, we need to guard our hearts and make sure that we don't go the way that that man went. Amen.